Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is an epic keyboard work written by Johann Sebastian Bach. It's called the Goldberg Variations. This is a live recording of me playing it on our Hamburg Steinway here in Armstrong Auditorium. According to music historians, this piece was originally written to soothe the insomnia of a Count Kaiserling who frequently visited the city of Leipzig, where Bach was employed at the time. Bach wrote the piece for the Count's harpsichordist, a man by the name of Goldberg, to play for the troubled nobleman. Music has been used as a therapy or even cure for various mental and even physical ailments. Today on Music for Life, we will explore these therapeutic qualities of music. In our segment, Sounds of Scripture, we will see the earliest record of music therapy. In Classroom Corner, we will explore the health benefits of singing in an ensemble. And in our segment, Backstage Banter, I sit down with a music therapist, Amber Loomis, of the Zeta Music Therapy Clinic in Norman, Oklahoma.
Music is one of the few things that we do that uses the entire area of our brain. So if there are certain areas that might be damaged due to disease or traumatic brain injury, we can use music to sort of access other areas and reroute and sort of try to get to some of those same thoughts and feelings that we didn't necessarily have access to without that.
All this on today's episode of Music for Life called Music for Health. A few weeks back, a friend of mine sent me an article from CNN dated November 6, 2009. So this goes back a few years, but it's a story from World War II. It says it was 2 weeks after D-Day, a few miles from the bloody shores of Omaha Beach. An airstrip had been carved out of the Normandy countryside, costing the lives of 28 Army engineers at the hands of German snipers. A lone sniper still remained in the nighttime distance. Despite the risk, Captain Jack Tueller felt compelled to play his trumpet. He'd used it on many a starlit night to entertain the men of the 508th Squadron, 404th Fighter Group. I was told, "Captain, don't play tonight. Your trumpet makes the most glorious sound." But I was stressed, he said. He was so troubled that he was willing to take a chance the sniper wouldn't fire. I thought to myself, that German sniper is as lonely and scared as I am. How can I stop him from firing? So I played that German's love song, Lili Marleen, made famous in the late 30s by Marlene Dietrich, the famous German actress. And I wailed that trumpet over those apple orchards of Normandy, and he didn't fire. The next morning, the military police came up to Tueller and told him they had a German prisoner on the beach who kept saying, "Who played that trumpet last night?" I grabbed my trumpet and went down to the beach. There was a 19-year-old German, scared and lonesome. He was dressed like a French peasant to cloak his role as a sniper. And crying, he said, "I couldn't fire because I thought of my fiancé. I thought of my mother and father." And he says, "My role is finished." He stuck out his hand and shook the hand of the enemy, Tueller said. But he was no enemy because music had soothed the savage beast. And that's a quote from Jack Tueller, who said music had soothed the savage beast. Now that quote right there, we've heard that a lot. But actually, it's a slight misquote of a phrase that was written years ago by playwright William Congreve. It was in his 1697 play, The Mourning Bride, which has this famous phrase, "Music hath charms to soothe a savage breast, to soften rocks, or bend a knotted oak." And so that's often misquoted or misattributed, but the idea that music has soothing or even healing power is a prevalent one throughout human history. Francis Bacon said, "The poets did well to conjoin music and medicine, because the office of medicine is but to tune the curious harp of man's body." Shakespeare referenced the power of music in The Two Gentlemen of Verona. He references the mythological Orpheus, who rescued his beloved Eurydice from Hades by playing beautiful music on his lyre. Orpheus has come to stand for the healing power of music and subsequently the importance of music education. Several composers set the tale of Orpheus to music in operas or in songs. And here's the quote from Shakespeare. "Orpheus's lute was strung with poet's sinews, whose golden touch could soften steel and stones, make tigers tame, and huge leviathans forsake unsounded deeps to dance on sands." A more famous quote from Shakespeare on the power of music, and another reference to this Orpheus, can be found in Henry VIII. In it, Queen Catherine says, "Orpheus with his lute made trees and the mountain tops that freeze bow themselves when he did sing. To his music plants and flowers ever sprung as suns and showers there had made a lasting spring. Everything that heard him play, even the billows of the sea, hung their heads and then lay by. In sweet music is such art, killing care and grief of heart fall asleep or hearing die." This particular passage has been set to music notably by William Schumann, a 20th century American composer, and by Ralph Vaughan Williams, an English composer of the early 20th century. Here is Felicity Lott singing Vaughan Williams' setting of this Shakespearean text. That was Felicity Lott singing Orpheus with his lute, text by William Shakespeare, music by Ralph Vaughan Williams. That's a famous segment of Shakespearean text from Henry VIII. It discusses the soothing and healing power of music through the mythological tale of Orpheus. But this concept also goes back to the very pages of the Bible. To explore that, let's get into our first segment, Sounds of Scripture, where we survey the Bible's many references to music to see what ancient music was like. This is a dance number from an original stage production we did here at Armstrong Auditorium called David, the Endless Throne Begins. I played a bit of this before in another program. This is the scene where King Saul is troubled by an evil spirit, represented in this production by a lone dancer in black. The music is supposed to sound troubled. When the harp enters the texture, this represents the young David fulfilling his assignment to play for the neurotic king. Once the harp gets warmed up, essentially, the young David begins playing a tune. This tune is still overpowered by the troubled music of the beginning of the piece. But then eventually these sounds and the dancer in black are driven away by the strains of the harp, and this is visually represented by three fiery clad dancers pushing out the evil spirit. This account of David playing to soothe King Saul can be found in 1 Samuel 16. 1 Samuel 16:23 reads, "And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took a harp and played with his hand, so Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him." Here is, I would argue, the earliest record of music therapy. Music used specifically as a cure here for spiritual, mental, and emotional ailments. Studies are plenteous today about the positive effects of music on mental and even physical health. The human mind and body are extremely receptive to the harmony of numbers that is music. These sounds provide significant health benefits, much like clean air from the atmosphere and nutritious food from the ground. They have been proven to speed the body's natural healing process and to strengthen the cognitive and emotional components of the mind. MSNBC.com contributor Bill Briggs explained, "Sound waves travel through the air into the ears and buzz the eardrums and bones in the middle ears. To decode the vibration, your brain transforms that mechanical energy into electrical energy, sending the signal to the cerebral cortex, a hub for thought, perception, and memory. Within that control tower, the auditory cortex forwards the message on to brain centers that direct emotion, arousal, anxiety, pleasure, and creativity. And there's another stop upstairs. That electrical cue hits the hypothalamus, which controls heart rate and respiration, plus your stomach and skin nerves, explaining why a melody may give you butterflies or goosebumps. Of course, all this communication happens far faster than a single drum beat." And that's from MSNBC Health, June 1st, 2009. Just as God created nutritious food, fresh air, and clean water to enhance our health, He also made music with physically edifying properties. In 1998, a Nobel Prize-winning discovery showed how cells in our bodies create nitric oxide in waves, releasing the gas into the body tissue around them in a process called puffing. This puffing can boost cell vitality and vascular flow, aid in resisting stress, strengthen the immune system, diminish depression, improve digestion, and impart higher levels of energy, stamina, and mental clarity. Dr. John Beaulieu found that when humans listen simply to tuning forks, not to mention certain other types of music, their cells automatically puff. More recently, Dr. Michael Miller of the Center for Preventative Cardiology at the University of Maryland Medical Center found a similar effect of this release of nitric oxide in the heart. He said that listening to music that we consider joyful can cause endothelial tissue, a layer of cells lining the interior surface of blood vessels, to expand, thereby increasing blood flow to the heart and other vital organs. And that's a quote from MetaFastHealth.org, August 31st, 2009. The American Heart Association published a study that year stating that musical phrases 10 seconds or longer can cause the heart to synchronize its inherent cardiovascular rhythm to the beat of the music. That's from AmericanHeart.MediaRoom.com, June 22, 2009. Luciano Bernardi, head researcher in the study, said, "It is not only the emotion that creates the cardiovascular changes, but this study suggests that also the opposite might be possible, that cardiovascular changes may be the substrate for emotions, likely in a bidirectional way. The physical effects of music on the mental and emotional state is astounding." Dr. Oliver Sacks, musician and neurologist, writes about the effects of music on schizophrenic patients in his book Musicophilia. He says this, "Psychiatrists speak of schizophrenic people as having negative symptoms, difficulties making contact with others, lack of motivation, and above all, flat affect, as well as positive ones, hallucinations, delusions. While medication can damp down the positive symptoms, those hallucinations, delusions, it rarely has an effect on the negative ones, difficulties making contact with others, lack of motivation, flat affect. So it rarely has an effect on the negative ones, that is medication, which are often more disabling," he writes. "And it is here that music therapy can be particularly useful and may help open up isolated, asocial people in a humane and uncoercive way." That's from his book, Musicophilia. That's Dr. Oliver Sacks. "Unlike medication, which can only take patients in one direction," basically is what he's saying, "music has the power to bring the patients back to center." Quoting music therapist Greta Schulthorpe, Sacks writes, "There are disturbed people who become calm and silent people who give voice, frozen people who beat time." Sacks also discusses music's profound effects on Parkinson patients and amnesiacs. He sums up one of his chapters, "As music seems to resist or survive the distortion of dreams or Parkinsonism or the losses of amnesia or Alzheimer's, so it may resist the distortions of psychosis and be able to penetrate the deepest states of melancholia or madness, sometimes when nothing else can." This was the case with King Saul in the first biblical record of music therapy. We quoted 1 Samuel 16:23, which showed that. At the end of his book, Dr. Sacks states that, "To those who are lost in dementia, music is not some trivial luxury of life, but a necessity, and can have a power beyond anything else to restore them to themselves and to others, at least for a while." Now, that account where David played to soothe Saul was "at least for a while." And it was not just a one-time occasion. 1 Samuel 18:10 reads, "And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand." King Saul constantly needed the soothing remedy that David's music could provide. The evil spirit that God allowed, it says, could not trouble Saul when his neurons were being occupied by such harmonious tones. The indication is that this was a daily activity for David. That phrase, "David played with his hand as at other times," would better be translated, "David played with his hand day by day." David's performances for Saul may have been daily. This particular account of David playing for Saul ended with Saul resisting the pleasing sounds of David's kinnor, and him lashing out by throwing the javelin at David, as verse 11 shows. And it was not long after that when David had to flee for his life from Saul. Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6, also have an interesting reference to music. This is referencing a future time. It says, "Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert." That's verses 5 and 6 of Isaiah chapter 35. The Bible is foretelling of a coming utopia where the deaf will be able to hear music, and there will be dancing, even from those who used to be lame. And at this juncture, I want to dwell momentarily on the phrase, "the tongue of the dumb sing," as relates specifically to music therapy. Dr. Sachs, still in that book, Musicophilia, tells the story of a man who had severe expressive aphasia following a stroke in his late 60s, and who remained totally speechless even after 2 years of speech therapy. The break for him came when Connie Tomino, the music therapist at our hospital, heard him singing one day outside her clinic. He was singing Old Man River very tunefully and with great feeling, but only getting two or three words of the song. Even though speech therapy had been given up with Samuel, who by then was regarded as hopeless, Connie felt that music therapy might be helpful. She started to meet with him 3 times a week for half-hour sessions in which she would sing with him or accompany him on the accordion. Mr. S was soon able, singing along with Connie, to get all the words of Old Man River and then of many other ballads and songs he had learned growing up in the 1940s. And as he did this, he started to show the beginnings of speech. Within 2 months, he was making short but appropriate responses to questions. Even those with severe speech impediments can become great vocalists. Stutterer and country music legend Mel Tillis is a case in point. And the reason I bring up these examples here is because the Bible's prophecies concerning the healing of the dumb are related to music. What an inspiring biblical reference to music in relation to healing. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today on this episode we are talking about music for health, exploring the therapeutic and health properties of music. We've already discussed how literary giants like Shakespeare and others have referenced this idea of the healing properties of music. But long before then, there is evidence in history of many others who subscribed to this belief. For ages, men have exploited the physical, emotional, mental, and even spiritual health properties of music. Many trace this knowledge back to Pythagoras, the musical Greek mathematician, who supposedly could tame animals through his lyre playing, though, as we just showed in Sounds of Scripture, it goes back even further. But the specifics of what the Pythagoreans taught about it is interesting. Jamie James writes about this in his book, The Music of the Spheres. The Pythagoreans taught the body is like a string that vibrates, making continuous but unheard music, and also like a string, it vibrates sympathetically to the sounds being produced around it. If you play a note or sound a frequency, and there's a string in the room that's close enough to those sound waves, and that string is at a certain tautness to vibrate at that frequency, that string will sympathetically vibrate. Jamie James points out that the human instrument sympathetically vibrates when, for instance, the string of a lyre is plucked. Vibration has been described as both a physical phenomenon and a vitalizing spirit or force. This music is what the Pythagoreans called musica humana, the human music. It's sort of the idea of the music of the spheres that we talked about in a previous episode, but within the human body. Pythagoras believed that music has the power to soothe or awaken tension in someone because of how our bodies sympathetically vibrate to that music surrounding us. Now, when we get into more modern music history, that of the standard repertoire, we find a variant of this philosophy in the Baroque era. This idea was called the Doctrine of Affections. This doctrine tried to explain the effects that music had on the emotional responses that a person would have to music. Lorenzo Giacomini, who lived in the late 16th century, wrote a work that described these affections not as emotions, but as a spiritual movement or operation of the mind in which it is attracted or repelled by an object it has come to know as a result of an imbalance in the animal spirits and vapors that flow continually throughout the body. So theorists suppose that the body contained these fluids, basically, or these affections that moved through the body in response to changes in music. Now, obviously, this is not the conventional wisdom of today, but it did affect how they wrote music, that composers were trying to impact human emotion. These fluid movements, they believed, resulted if a piece of music contained devices such as deceptive cadences, I can explain what those are later, chord suspensions, I'll explain that, that's momentary tension basically followed by resolution, ornamentation, frills added to the sound to add excitement, tempo changes, or dynamic variations. So all those devices were said to produce an emotional response because they affected how these fluids would course through the body. Now, some may consider music written back this far, with people in grand wigs and pantaloons, as somewhat stuffy or reserved. But this is a complete misnomer. This doctrine of affections shows how emotionally impactful that Baroque composers intended their music to be. To explain this further, I want to go to a piano and show you a little bit of this.
Okay, so I'm here at the Steinway Piano in Armstrong Auditorium, and we've been talking about the Baroque doctrine of affections. This idea impacted the way harmony was treated, and those styles influenced all the composers who were composing at this time, no matter to what degree they believed in the actual doctrine itself or the validity of that, certainly they would have been caught in the style of the time, using all these devices that would be impactful on human health and human emotion. And so the Baroque composers were trying to be extremely emotional. Their music was extremely deep feeling. And to illustrate this, I want to play you a couple pieces by Bach and explain what's going on here. But first, let me explain a device they used called suspension. A suspension is where a note of a chord is changed that creates a tension in the chord. It creates a dissonance in the chord. And then that suspension, once it is resolved, creates a feeling of relaxation or resolution, and feeling that happens. So if I had a chord like this, what we call a C major chord, that's made up of three notes, C, E, and G. Now, if I change that middle note to be the note above or below the note it's supposed to be, instead of an E, if I play an F, for instance, that's called a suspension. And that's a very tense sound. And Baroque composers loved that tension. They loved the dissonance that created, especially when followed by resolution. So, for instance, if here was the suspension, then here is the resolution. The suspension could work the other way. Instead of playing an E, they could play the note below it. They could ask for the D. And then resolve back up to the E. So this idea of suspension and resolution was huge in the Baroque era. This created that feeling of tension and relaxation. At the beginning of this episode, I played you the aria from the Goldberg Variations, the main theme from this set of variations that Bach wrote to soothe the insomnia of a particular nobleman who was visiting Leipzig. And he wrote 30 variations on this aria. One variation in particular that I want to play for you shows this idea of suspension, where a chord is played in the piano, And then when the chord changes, one of the notes holds over from the previous chord, creating a tension or a suspension feel, and then that suspension is resolved. Here's just the opening of this variation, variation number 18. So we start with this chord, and then Bach goes to this chord. But he doesn't go to the top note right away. He goes this chord, and then when he goes to the next chord, this note is still sustaining, this note is still suspended, and then finally it is resolved. So he goes from this chord, and then he changes chords, and then that suspension is resolved. And this happens all throughout this piece. I'll play through it, and I'll point those out as I play. So there was a suspension, and then the resolution. Here's one. Yeah, so it was that was the suspension, and then it resolved to there. And then here, that right there is an ornament, a trill, and that was also added to add emotional content to the pieces of music that were being composed. So we'll start at that ornament. So here's the chord, but this is still holding on. And then Bach resolves it. Here's a new chord, but this note is still holding through. And then he resolves it. So he's got this note still holding over, suspending from the previous chord, and he states it again so we remember, yeah, this note doesn't belong. And there it is, there it relaxes. Same idea. Yeah, tension and relaxation. Here's the final chord of this section, but it's still hanging on. Resolves. And now when we play it all the way through in the momentum of the piece, hopefully your ear can pick up on those notes that are holding over from the last chord that don't belong in the new chord, so it creates a momentary tension, and then finally, once resolved, a relaxation. So here's variation 18 from Bach's Goldberg Variations. Another piece by Bach where we really hear this tension and relaxation, this suspension and resolution, is in his B flat minor prelude from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Book One. We talked in a previous episode about the Well-Tempered Clavier, his celebration, really, of this tuning system on this keyboard instrument that allowed every key, every major and minor key, to be played in and sound in tune. And in this B flat minor prelude, we have all sorts of examples of this Baroque idea of relishing in harmonic dissonance and then presenting the relaxation or the resolution of such dissonance. And that creates an intense emotional effect. It was supposed to strongly affect the listener and impact the health, the emotional health of the human body. This B flat minor prelude has what we call at the very beginning a pedal point, one note that sustains through many, many chord changes. The pedal point might be best illustrated by explaining an organ, which has manuals for the organist to play with the hands, but then the feet play a manual down below, and those pedals can sustain a particular note while the organist is changing notes above on the fingered manuals. Well, here we have a pedal point where there's a B-flat presented at the beginning of this prelude, and the B-flat doesn't leave for two full slow bars. And during those two slow bars, Bach is changing the chords, and the B-flat, that's the pedal point below, doesn't always belong in the chords that are happening above it. So it creates this tension as the B-flat keeps stating itself. So listen to these opening two bars. And there the pedal point leaves when the bottom of the left hand does that. But this note, repeating over and over, goes with this chord, and then there's this chord, and that's very tense, and that's incredibly tense, that's still tense, that's a suspension right there, and the resolution, right there. Here's the suspension again, and then the resolution, and then another tense chord, doesn't really go this. So we have an extremely tense moment, but then it is soon relaxed. Now, as we go throughout this piece, you will hear constantly a note, just like in the Goldberg variations, that holds over into a new chord, and it doesn't quite fit into that chord, so it creates a suspension. Bach also uses all sorts of other techniques to create tension and relaxation. So I'll keep playing and point some of these things out to you. There's a very tense three notes resolved right there. Then he goes on. And there's a very tense interval right there. Resolving to somewhat less tense, but still tense chord, to this. But then as soon as he resolves in this prelude, what's beautiful about it, as soon as he resolves, he leads us into another exquisite and tense chord. Because what did we expect? That's what we expected, but we got a holdover and then finally resolving to here. Bach does something next that's very common in the Baroque era called a motive and a sequence. This is where a motive or a musical idea is presented, and then it is repeated, what's known as the sequence, It's repeated a step higher or lower. So it's not just a motive that's just repeated verbatim. It's repeated a step lower or a step higher. And in this case, what it does is the motive itself is very tense and the sequence is very relaxed. So here's the motive. And then the sequence is much more relaxed. So we have that motive, a tense motive, and then a relaxed sequence. Hear that again. Very tense. Very sad. More sunny. More hopeful. Then he goes on. There's that note that doesn't belong. But then he resolves. Here, what do we expect? But what does he give us? A tense suspension. And then he resolves it, thankfully. Hear all these tense chords. So he does this, a pretty simple, lovely chord. So it's very simple. There's nothing tense about that. But there's something very tense about that. Listen to that again. Another one. Listen to that. These tense chords are going somewhere. The most tense of all chords is held as long as you want with that fermata, then a silence. He simplifies it. What do we expect? We expect this. But what he does, that B-flat minor chord, he changes one note to make it a B-flat major chord. Listen to that. Think of what you expect. He does this. By adding that note, it's just a sunnier sound, just a more hopeful sound. And that particular cadence where you expect it to go to the home chord, but it goes to, instead of the home minor chord, it changes the home chord from a minor chord to a major chord. That's called a Picardy third. That's what music theorists named it. In the fugue from this B-flat minor prelude and fugue that I'm playing, at the very end, he does that. And he holds off on that Picardy third, or that sunny, hopeful major ending, to the very last chord. I'll play you just the last four bars of this fugue just to illustrate another example of a Picardy third. What do you expect? You expect this. But listen to what he does. Let me play you this entire B-flat minor prelude. It's pretty short, and I want you to listen for all these tension and relaxation moments, all these extremely complex, rich, and tense chords, and how emotionally packed they are, how moving they are. Thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. This is KPCG. Today we are talking about the health or therapeutic properties of music. In this episode titled Music for Health, we've been talking about the Baroque era, and this was replete with this idea that music was intended to have a significant impact on the body, on the emotions, on even the well-being of the listener. Now, as we move ahead in history, there isn't as much explicitly about the classical era in terms of its composer's belief in music therapy, but there have been studies to indicate the health benefits from the music of one of the classical era composers, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Now, a study that received quite a bit of press years ago was the one touting the so-called Mozart effect. Now, it was trying to give evidence of increased cognition while listening to Mozart. Now, though the study has been undermined since it first came out, it did find something that has been corroborated by other studies, and that's worth looking at. That is, it found improvement in epileptics when they listened to Mozart's music for a certain amount of time each day. They claim that this is due to the electrical stimulation provided from Mozart's music. Three studies have been conducted using EEG tests, which measure the electrical patterns in a person's brain. In 1998, 29 people who had shown a high level of epileptic brain activity during their first test were asked to listen to Mozart's Sonata for Two Pianos in D, Kirchhoff 448, during their next EEG test. This was the same piece used by the Mozart effect researchers. 23 out of the 29 people who took the test while listening to music showed less epileptic brain activity. A 2011 study in Taiwan focused on 58 children with focal epilepsy. Researchers asked them to listen to 8 minutes of Mozart, K448, that same piece, once a day. The results of their EEG brain tests were recorded after 1, 2, and 6 months. For 47 of the 58 children, each of the EEG test results showed a decrease in epileptic activity. In another Taiwanese study the same year, 11 children with refractory epilepsy were asked to listen to Mozart's K448 once a day before bed for 6 months. The total number of seizures the children had over a period of 6 months was counted. The results show that 8 out of the 11 children became seizure-free, or the number of seizures was greatly reduced in the months they listened to the music. Now, I've played you the first movement of that Sonata for Two Pianos in a previous episode. Now, the most common, the most universal form of music that was written or performed for the express purpose of calming or soothing would have to be, and maybe you've guessed it, the lullaby. This brings us to the Romantic era composer Johannes Brahms, who wrote the most famous lullaby of all time. It was originally written as one of the many Lieder, that is German art songs, that Brahms wrote. This was one of a set of 5 Lieder, or 5 art songs. This particular one was called Wiegenlied, which means lullaby, Guten Abend, Gute Nacht, good evening, good night, and Brahms dedicated it to a friend of his who had just had a baby. Since its Vienna premiere in 1869, it has undergone many, many arrangements and adaptations. This is the Eroica Trio performing theirs. Thank you. That was Johannes Brahms' famous lullaby, performed by the Eroica Trio. The lullaby is a classic example of music intended to soothe or calm the listener. And today on Music for Life, we're talking about the therapeutic and health properties of music. We are going to move away from the lullaby discussion for a little bit, and we'll have a special lullaby for dessert today. But when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion of this idea of music as part of rehabilitation. We're going to continue discussing the Romantic era. We also will have our segment Classroom Corner, where we will talk about the health benefits of singing in a group or in an ensemble. And then we will also have a special backstage banter segment with a music therapist here in Oklahoma City. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back.